Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. That's the sound of the ukulele, played by virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro. His trio comes to Fresno's Tower Theater this Sunday. And on today's show, we'll hear about his latest album, as well as what concertgoers can expect. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. A sick women's group in Bakersfield is fighting domestic abuse with a resource hotline. And we introduce you to a father whose strategy to end gun violence in a southwest Fresno neighborhood started with the loss of his own children.
But first, a quick recap of the news. Despite an impeachment inquiry in Congress, Trump supporters held a rally against impeachment yesterday in Bakersfield. Organizer Craig Luther, a military historian in Tehachapi, said he was thrilled with the turnout of around 100 people.
We're pushing back because we love the direction our country's moving in. Jobs are being created at home. The economy is just bursting.
He also said he had never been flipped off so much in his life.
In Fresno, the police department has sworn in a new chief. A 40-year veteran of the Fresno PD, Andy Hall, signaled he'd like to expand community policing with efforts like youth mentoring and the Neighborhood Watch.
These activities are part of our commitment to the community. This interaction is vital to building trust, keeping youth away from gangs and a life of crime.
He'll remain chief only until January 2021.
The State Water Board on Wednesday approved a decade-in-the-making plan to reduce the harmful nitrate and salts being discharged into Central Valley groundwater. The ag community and drinking water advocates hail the process as progress toward a compromise. However, advocates say a provision allowing polluters up to 35 years to reduce their nitrate to acceptable levels is still too long.
Police in Lemoore have arrested two men on suspicion of stealing $50,000 worth of cheese from a Leprino Foods plant. According to Detective Osvaldo Maldonado, the key was social media, where Leprino employees had seen the suspects selling the mozzarella.
They described and confirmed that that was their cheese based on the way it was packaged, the serial numbers on the packaging, and just the way that the product looked.
Police then tracked down the suspects, who are now booked in Kings County Jail.
Catch more local news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. In July, Fresno Mayor Lee Brand vetoed the funding for a program designed to reduce gun violence in cities. It's called Advance Peace, and it works with the most violent shooters by consistently giving them the resources to change their lives. One of its biggest advocates who pushed hard for the program to come to Fresno is Aaron Foster. He's a father who lost both of his children to gun violence, and for a couple of years, he's been running his own version of Advance Peace to protect his Southwest Fresno community. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez takes us to the corner of Ivy and Lorena Streets, where Foster starts his day.
What's happening with you? Hey, I'm on top of him, man.
Aaron Foster constantly stops to greet people who are walking by, or he waves to them across the street.
It's just the hood. We call it the block. Every neighborhood got a block. So since I'm associated with this area, this is my son. This was his area.
A son who was shot and killed in 2013. He also lost a daughter to gun violence 2 years ago. And since then, he's been out here every day to make sure no one else has to bury their children.
The devil don't take no days off. We can't either. I get up in the morning. I come and check the blocks. We go around, check the temperature. What's going on? So just got into it. They ran a fade last night. A fade is a fight.
Fights turn into murder, Foster says. But he believes people don't really want to shoot each other. But oftentimes, he says, that's the only way gang members know how to handle their differences.
If one person gets killed, it engages a war. So it's like one body on the floor, 30 people mad. You got four people that want to avenge this death.
So Foster says he tries to prevent deaths from happening. He monitors social media posts to see if there's any threats of violence. And he drives the neighborhood to see which streets are quiet. A quiet street is a sign that tension is brewing.
But we get in front of the tension. Just loosen it up a little bit. Then we can coexist.
He drives around, or what he calls hitting the loop, every day in his pickup truck.
This is the Southwest Fresno that no one sees. Poverty is obvious. Yeah, this guy right here is one of the ones.
One of the dozen or so community members who work alongside Foster to keep the peace.
What's going on with you, man? Yeah, this is Sean Robinson. He does the Little League. So what do you think that you do, man, to reduce gun violence in our community, brother?
I go direct to the problem. You go right to the problem. You go right to the neighborhoods. Where the problems consist at.
Robinson says Foster reaches out to people like him because Foster knows they're the only ones who can connect with gang members.
Right now we're dealing with adolescents that's got guns. We ain't dealing with grown-ups. You know, I was once one of them, so I can blatantly, go direct to the source.
Foster was too. He says his past gang affiliations give him credibility.
One of the criteria is you had to once be a very violent individual that has changed your life so that you can be the example of change. People don't believe you. And now you can't, once you say that you changed, the streets watching to critique it.
Foster says he and other community activists had to prove themselves before people would take them seriously.
Now we're trying to stop beefs from happening with young people.
Right.
That's what we do every day. But without people like Sean Robinson, Joby Jones, myself, and a handful of others that I can't think of off the top of my head, Southwest Fresno would be a war zone right now. And that's not what I think. That's what I absolutely know.
Joby Jones agrees. He's also a community leader in this fight against gun violence. On this day, he's at the Hinton Center on the corner of South Fairview and East Church. He watches as kids hit a punching bag.
So we're running an after-school program, boxing, just a safe place for them. I know a lot of them deal with anger. So I think if we get a boxing ring somewhere, they just come, get their frustration out for the help a lot.
Jones works with younger kids who are at risk of being recruited into gangs. He says that's why they come here. Some of these kids are bullied. They don't have parents, or their family members have been murdered.
And a lot of times, man, our kids just need somebody to be around. Because I know that's one thing about the streets. They around you all the time. They feeding into you. And eventually, because they're always there, you will gravitate toward that stuff.
Instead, Jones tries to point young people in a positive direction. Outside of the Hinton Center, Fresno Police Captain Mark Salazar says this approach works. He says since he started working in this area in 2016, shootings are down more than 40%. He attributes much of this work to people like Jones, Robinson, and Foster.
And so what we have in Southwest Fresno is tremendous momentum that I have never seen in my 23-year career. And because of that momentum and because of us working together, that's why shootings are down. Typically, you'll hear law enforcement say because of their strategies and tactics, crime is down. I credit our partnerships.
Partnerships with people who understand and care deeply about keeping kids alive.
And a guy like Aaron, who again, he's a friend of mine, he could reach people that I can't. Even my officers can't. He can reach people that the pastors can't reach. And so, and as long as we recognize that and appreciate that, I think it goes a long way.
It's that kind of connection Foster hoped to achieve on a greater scale with Advanced Peace. After Brand vetoed the program, the council directed him to meet with community advocates to come up with another plan. Foster is still waiting.
They gave us a 90-day window to come up with an alternative gun violence reduction strategy, but that hasn't happened. The 90 days passed. Conversation is gone.
Brandt has said he was skeptical about Advanced Peace because there weren't any studies backing it. But the American Public Health Association just published a study that says the program is working in Richmond, California. Brandt has declined multiple requests for an interview, but in an email, he says the study will help guide the city. But Foster says the people making these decisions are the farthest away from the pain.
So as we wait for the mayor to care, somebody's gonna die.
Foster says he doesn't want that to happen. but he knows it will. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. PG&E is under fire again. The California Public Utility Commission has called an emergency hearing today to question company leaders about the recent power outage that left over 700,000 homes and businesses in California without electricity for days. As part of the statewide California Dream Collaboration, Capital Public Radio's Scott Rodd reports.
Taverna Pellegrini sat empty last week as the rolling blackouts left the East Bay enclave of Orinda without power for days. Instead of serving up wine and veal cutlets to the usual dinner rush, owner Dario Hajian was busy throwing away food at risk of going bad.
The red meats, the burgers, the lamb chops, pork chops, that stuff there is very delicate. From here, we had to throw everything away.
Most of the shelves in the walk-in fridge had to be cleared when the temperature crept above 50 degrees.
All of this stuff here had gone bad. There was, you know, the only other way to find out is if somebody gets sick, and I wasn't going to take that chance.
Hajian says he ditched up to $1,500 worth of prepared food and ingredients, a substantial loss for a small restaurant, on top of having to close for a couple days. He says PG&E gave adequate notice that, because of dangerous weather conditions and the risk of wildfires, the electricity might be turned off. But once everything went dark, the utility provided little help.
I tried to get on their website to see their maps and stuff. None of that worked. It was just non-existent, you know. I called PG&E multiple times and no answer. You know, those things would have helped a little bit.
The lack of information and assistance from PG&E frustrated hundreds of thousands of customers. Now the state is demanding answers and action, as the public safety outages could become the new normal.
We're seeing a scale and scope of something that no state in the 21st century should experience. What's happened is unacceptable, and it's happened because of neglect.
That was Governor Gavin Newsom speaking at the State Office of Emergency Services during the shutoff. He has called for an investigation into PG&E's, quote, astounding lack of preparation. And the State Utility Commission is demanding PG&E make substantial changes to the system ahead of future outages, including better coordination with local governments, hiring additional staff to handle customer calls, and upgrading equipment in areas most vulnerable to fires. PG&E spokesperson Jeff Smith says the company stands by the decision to shut off power due to the risk of wildfires, but acknowledges it's not a perfect solution.
We do understand it's really frustrating for customers. We understand that in some instances, much more than just an inconvenience, that it's a real hardship.
PG&E is currently gathering feedback, but Smith says because the utility can't control the weather, it has no plans to reimburse customers for damages caused by the outage.
Well, customers certainly are always welcome to file claims. Typically, in these instances, claims will not be paid.
The utility declared bankruptcy earlier this year after facing tens of billions of dollars in potential liabilities in the wake of last year's devastating fires. It plans to invest up to $3 billion in a wildfire mitigation program, which would require equipment upgrades and vegetation reduction along thousands of miles of power lines. But Stephen Weissman says if these kinds of planned outages are indeed going to become more commonplace, the utility should do more.
PG&E can be cheerleader for having on-site generation and storage rather than resisting it.
Weissman is a lecturer at UC Berkeley and a former administrative law judge at the Utility Commission. He argues PG&E should begin promoting and even funding power solutions like microgrids that could help protect customers in the event of an outage. Hajian, the owner of Taverna Pellegrini in Orinda, would love to become more self-sufficient the next time around.
I'm in talks with an electric contractor to get a backup generator, but it's costly.
He says he hasn't budgeted for the upgrade, but the restaurant can't afford to close every time PG&E decides to cut off the power. In Orinda, I'm Scott Rodd.
You're listening to the renowned violinist Vijay Gupta. He played with the LA Philharmonic for 11 years, joining it at the age of 19. That was before winning a 2018 MacArthur Fellowship, also known as a Genius Grant. And he's the founder of Street Symphony, an organization that performs free concerts for LA's homeless community and in county jails. Next Thursday, Gupta will perform and speak at the Fresno Arts Council's 34th Annual Horizon Awards at the Tower Theater. Today, he's joining us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Valley Edition, VJ.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've made some interesting comparisons about how you feel being in the spotlight at Disney Hall when performing with the LA Phil and being on Skid Row, where tens of thousands of homeless people live in LA. Could you talk about that?
Certainly. Well, when we go into a clinic or shelter in the neighborhood of Skid Row, we're presenting music not as a form of entertainment or to kind of prove what great artists we are, but rather to offer a pathway back to human connection. Our audiences in Skid Row are not there to judge us, but also are truly there to connect with us as people. And so when we think about the work of Street Symphony, it's not based on a unilateral kind of outreach model, but in a much more mutual, reciprocal relationship where we are transformed as much by the musical experiences we present as we hope our audiences are moved.
And so you include musicians who live on Skid Row.
That's right. So, you know, we are truly invested in creating a consciousness shift from Skid Row being referred to as a place of problems and urban blight to really viewing Skid Row as a recovery community. And for this community, music and art is a pathway back to dignity and hope. And so we work with musicians like the drummer Ray Lewis or the composer Benjamin Shirley, who's actually now a full-time member of Street Symphony's staff.
And I know your perspective about Skid Row changed after you read a column by LA Times columnist Steve Lopez. He wrote about Nathaniel Ayers, the Juilliard-trained musician who suffered from schizophrenia and lived on Skid Row, and that column ultimately, or those columns ultimately resulted in a book, The Soloist. But it also gave you a different entree into this world. Can you talk about that and how that influenced Street Symphony?
It really did. So I was invited by Mr. Lopez to actually work with Nathaniel, who I refer to lovingly as Mr. Ayers. We developed a very close connection and bond, and Mr. Ayers had actually asked me to be his violin teacher. And I think I was 21 or 22. I had only been in the LA Phil for a couple of months, and I was being asked to connect with an individual who had experienced several decades of being unhoused and had been diagnosed with a severe mental illness. And I had no way of really understanding how I could in effect any kind of change in Nathaniel's life. But really, it was him. It was Nathaniel who opened doors for me, because for Nathaniel, you know, Steve refers to music as his drug. Music was his way of being whole, of being human. And for many ways, music was that for me as well in my own experiences of mental illness or trauma or abuse in my own family. And so working with Nathaniel was actually opening a door to not only understanding a deeper role for myself as a musician in the world, but also understanding the Skid Row community as being home to a resilient, vibrant community of people who, sure, were experiencing addiction and poverty and recovering from incarceration and homelessness, but also were a neighborhood in their own right.
Well, there was a quote I read where you say the Skid Row community is one of the most vibrant artistic communities in America today.
So in Skid Row, Street Symphony is very lucky to work alongside a number of incredible arts leaders and partners. There's the Los Angeles Poverty Department, there's Studio 526, there is the Urban Voices Project. There are so many incredible artistic partners which create and present and curate art for this community. Next week in Skid Row is going to be the annual All Skid Row Festival of Artists, which is actually put on by Los Angeles Poverty Department, and they have a roster of over 900 artists who work and live in the Skid Row community. So truly in Skid Row, for the artists who live there, music is a way of creating culture. culture. And when we think about engaging communities, you know, we often think about, you know, what on earth can music do? What can art do? It's a waste of time. We should be housing people. But the truth is, we need to actually see people as people and not as the problems. People are not defined by the condition of homelessness or mental illness. They are people with stories first. And so art and music allows us to root ourselves in the humanity and dignity which we must afford to every single human being.
That's really beautiful. And you started playing violin at a very young age. Your parents were immigrants from India. They had immeasurably high standards. I believe you've said you grew up in an abusive household. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that those experiences also shape the way that you interact with people.
You know, the way that I grew up was, you know, complicated in the ways that so many lives are complicated, but especially the lives of immigrants, because I also know that my parents sacrificed absolutely everything that they could have for me and my brother to have the lives we had. And I also realized that this was, you know, my accomplishments were their pathway to being okay themselves. I live and work as an artist at the intersection of having a background that is both painful and joyful and privileged and unseen. And so being an artist actually allows me to hold the complexity and nuance of the multiplicity of experiences and perspectives that I've experienced in my life. And I think that's actually what we need now more than ever. We're experiencing a world where we have more isolation, more alienation, and more disconnection from ourselves. And building pathways to connection, to understand the quote-unquote other, is actually the most vital act of citizenship and humanity that I believe we can do today in our modern society. I believe that we ostracize and criminalize the most fragile and vulnerable members of our society because we have in some way ostracized the most fragile and vulnerable parts of ourselves. We see the ache and hurt in another person as being their problem. But the truth is, if you're in a cage, then I'm in a cage. And so this work is actually about our own collective liberation.
Right. And it's so easy to turn away from other people's problems and just sort of turn a blind eye. And I want to ask you about that, because I know every December, Street Symphony stages a performance of Handel's Messiah at the Midnight Mission, and attendees are kind of forced to look at a part of LA that maybe they'd prefer not to. Is that part of the effort?
It is very much part of the effort. I mean, I believe that it is the role of artists to equally provoke and disrupt as much as it is our job to heal and inspire. And you know, we not only want to provoke and break old behaviors for the sake of breaking them, but we want to create pathways to new restorative connections. So attendees at the Messiah Project are members of the Skid Row community and people who are, you know, perhaps affluent donors from neighborhoods like Beverly Hills or South Pasadena. But the truth is, everyone in that room has to sing, and everyone in that room has to show up as human beings first and undo the veneer of being somehow okay or somehow separated from the rest of our world. So at every Messiah Project, we also create hundreds of hygiene kits, these amenity bags for the Skid Row community. And our donors and our attendees from the outside community are actually invited to share these kits and have conversations and sit next to folks who experience homelessness, because often it's the formerly or currently unhoused folks who are the better singers in the room.
And have you witnessed some really incredible connections being made?
I truly have. I mean, the truth is, Street Symphony is a network of over 90 professional artists, my colleagues from the LA Phil and Master Chorale, but leading jazz and mariachi and West African musicians. And the truth is, this work is not about some sweeping social reform. Social change happens one person at a time. It happens one relationship at a time. And the truth is, this work is actually about leaning into those relationships and knowing that that even though we get to leave this community after one of our glorious programs, we have to return, we have to show up, we have to come back again and again, because the relationships exist in returning again and again.
And you gave up playing with the LA Phil after you won the MacArthur Fellowship. That must have been a huge leap of faith for someone who grew up perhaps feeling forced to do exactly what others expected of you.
It was a huge transition for me, and it continues to be a very vulnerable transition for me. I think what often happens, when one receives something called the quote-unquote genius grant, is people are, that recipient is often mistakenly referred to as a genius. And the truth is, I've never had more questions and more doubt in my life than I have this year. And I deeply miss my colleagues in the orchestra, but the truth is, I was standing backstage at Disney Hall in Tuxedo Tales, writing grants for Street Symphony and planning projects and ideas. So the MacArthur grant has actually allowed me to hire my full-time staff for the first time. As I mentioned, Benjamin Shirley, who is a member of the Skid Row community, is now our full-time director of community engagement. And I have an incredible musical colleague named Dustin Seo, who's a young cellist, who's our full-time director of musical programs at Street Symphony. But it is a serious consciousness shift, because I'm also asking myself for the first time in my life, who do I truly want to be as an artist myself? The truth is, I was never trained to be a CEO. I was never trained to be a policymaker. I was trained to be a violinist. And so this is the first time in my life I'm really, truly asking myself, well, what is my artistic purpose? What is my highest spiritual goal as a musician in this world? And that's a huge question for me.
So what is that like for you?
Well, it's incredibly vulnerable, but at the same time, I find that my relationship with the violin has really changed, because for me, making music is kind of like holding a mirror up to my soul. I know if I am whole and spiritually intact based on my relationship, the quality of my relationship with the violin itself, which is not something that happens in front of stages or cheering audiences. Often it happens in the practice room. You know, it's the act of sitting down and showing up again and again and again when there's no expectation of applause or recognition or the gift. And I think this is truly what artists have to teach the world around us, is that when we move beyond thinking of art as accomplishment and product, the artistic process is one of discipline and rigor and constant evolution. And I think that this is an incredible gift to think and live as an artist in the world today.
What has been the biggest challenge with Street Symphony?
One of the very biggest challenges is actually challenging the myth of the redemption story. I think that we have an obsession, perhaps even bordering on a fetish, with this idea that somehow music can solve homelessness, or that there is a redemption story or success story that is going to elevate us and somehow fix this work. And I think we kind of gravitate to having these silver bullets sweeping ideas around, well, if we just house them all, then they're off the streets and we've solved the problem. And the truth is, addiction and mental illness happens more behind closed doors than it happens on our streets. And so the truth is, if we're not looking at the people and only looking at the problems, then we're asking the wrong questions. And if we're only looking at the redemption stories and not holding space for people to have complicated, nuanced stories which involve the struggle and often the failure and the relapse, perhaps even death, that we're not really addressing the full complicated nuanced issues around us. And so one of the biggest challenges is around generating metrics for this work, because it seems that funders or policymakers only want to hear the redemption stories, and they don't want to hear the fact that actually, to enact real change, it's one person at a time, and it really requires us to show up every single day to this community again and again.
That's such an interesting point, and it does sound like it's all about the connection.
It has to be. It has to be. I mean, I actually think about the metaphor of making music and being in society as kind of similar to parenting or being in a relationship, that we continuously have to show up and be willing to be unconditional in our love. The moment that we put conditions on our love, the conditions on our relationships, we actually disrupt the ways in which we can actually interact with the world around us.
Well, Vijay Gupta, it's been a real honor speaking with you today.
Thank you. It's an honor being interviewed by you. Thank you so much for having me.
Again, Vijay Gupta will be performing and speaking at the Fresno Arts Council's Horizon Awards at the Tower Theater next Thursday.
Listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. It can be a challenge for anyone dealing with family violence or substance abuse to access the resources they need. But imagine what it's like for new immigrants to the United States. Advocates in Kern County are working to address these issues by providing a new resource hotline in English and Punjabi for the Sikh community. FM 89's Kathleen Shock spoke with Raji Brar, co-founder of the Bakersfield Sikh Women's Association, Kern County Deputy District Attorney Andrea Kohler, and Lewis Gill from the Alliance Against Family Violence.
So, Raji, I'd like to start with you. I understand that the idea for this resource hotline was born out of some truly tragic events that occurred in the Bakersfield community this year. Give us a sense of the background of how this project came about.
Yes. Well, this year we had a couple of incidences that were just really unfortunate and tragic in our community. Earlier this year, we had a situation where a young woman was pregnant, unbeknownst to her family, and ended up delivering the baby at home, and her mother buried the baby in the backyard. She actually killed the baby. And she did so out of, she didn't want to be shamed by our community, by the Sikh community. So it was just a tragic incident. And then, you know, a few months later, we had a daughter-in-law who was murdered by her father-in-law because she wanted to leave the family and was having an affair. And the father-in-law just, out of shame, again, didn't want to face the community and murdered her. So we had to just, the community was rocked. The Sikh community was just very rocked. And we had to really deal with some issues culturally that we kind of bury deep down and don't really talk about. And because of that, we had a few community meetings. And out of those meetings, we realized there was issues dealing with domestic violence, abuse, physical, sexual, emotional, a lot of drug abuse, you know, alcoholism, a lot of things that in our community we just don't talk about. And we had those conversations and we realized really quickly that we needed to have some sort of therapy, behavioral health, mental health services. And we realized that folks weren't going to come forward and they needed confidentiality. And so when this last incident occurred of the murder, we decided that we needed to get a resource line going. And I reached out to actually Cindy Lede, who works with Lewis Gill at the Alliance for Family Violence. And I asked her, what should I do? And how they got their line started. And she just gave me some advice and we got the line up. And then I got a call from our DA, Cynthia Zimmer, that day. And she was like, I want to help. And she told us about the Family Justice Center. And that's how I met Andrea, who's on the call with us, and went down there. And we have this line set up that's in bilingual, and it basically connects folks to resources that the county already has available to them. And so that's where we realized there was a need in our community. That people weren't talking about what was happening at home. Our culture does have an issue with sharing what's happening behind closed doors. They don't want to talk about things that affect their daughters or mothers. You know, in our culture, your daughter's virtue or your wife's virtue is held at such a high standard. And with it, there's some unfortunate ramifications that come with that.
Mm. WDA Kohler, tell us how you got involved with this. I mean, we heard a little bit about how you got involved with this project, but why did it appeal to you? What was going through your mind when you first heard about it?
Well, with our Family Justice Center, that's been up and running since January of 2018. And this year, we, you know, now that it's been running for a while, our focus has been largely on outreach to the communities. Domestic violence is not unique to a particular class of persons. It's kind of an equal opportunity crime. So we want to make sure that everyone in Kern County is aware that this is a resource that is available to them, irrespective of whether they speak English, whether they're here as immigrants, whether they are, whatever the situation is, we want to make sure that everyone is aware that the resource is available and that they feel comfortable using the resource. So much of our outreach is to outlying areas of Kern County, oftentimes to communities where English is not the primary language spoken. And we want to also assure those communities that you can come and report. You are in a safe, confidential, caring environment if you're concerned, because some citizens are not wanting to report. They're concerned about deportation. Oftentimes, the offenders, the perpetrators, threaten. You know, if you report this, then you'll be deported. I'll report you. And we want to make sure that that threat is taken away, that people realize. And that's with all communities. So we want to make sure that all communities, all citizens, all individuals that live here know that this is a resource available to them. We want to help.
Absolutely. And certainly issues around abuse, substance abuse, violence, sexual assault impact all communities. Lewis Gill, I'd love to bring you into the conversation. Tell us a bit about the Alliance Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault. And then also maybe some of the challenges that you've experienced in providing outreach to the Sikh community.
Sure. So the Alliance Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault is a local domestic violence and rape crisis center for much of Kern County. And we are very excited about Raji and the Bakersfield Sikh Women's Association starting this emergency line. Much of our history in the movement for domestic violence all started with primarily women in each other's kitchens taking phone calls from individuals so that they could get assistance. And so as that's grown, of course, facilities like ours have come to be, but there are still new individuals coming to our communities. And quite frankly, language barriers and also cultural competency is a real issue that can be a barrier for individuals. And we realize that as service providers, that we need to have folks answering the phone that can immediately relate with the individual and the experience that they're having. Because anybody that has lost their sense of safety or that feels fearful in their own homes because of intimate partner violence, we want to make sure there's the right person there to help them.
Raji, I understand that the hotline itself is staffed by women in the community who are bilingual, who speak both English and Punjabi. Can you speak to where are you finding these women, and what has the response been?
So for us, our nonprofit, the Bakersfield Sikh Women's Association, we're all volunteers. You know, we're all working moms, and we all have, you know, an 8-to-5. But we're a volunteer organization, and the way we've staffed this resource line, it's a voicemail answering system. So your call gets returned within the same day, if not within 24 hours. And it's ladies from our association, and believe it or not, we've had folks call in from all over saying, I want to help with the line, I want to help. And then we put them on a list, and the calls go to the next person. It's a really amazing system we have set up. And I want to speak to what Andrea mentioned about immigration status. We're noticing that a lot of calls that we are getting are individuals, because in our culture, we arrange marriages the norm. It's changing, but it's always been the norm. So we have a lot of gentlemen who go to India and get married, and it's an arranged marriage, and they come here, and the wives are green card holders. And there's a lot of abuse in some of these homes, and the women are really afraid to report because they're afraid they'll be sent back to India. So this is the common thing, that most of the calls we receive are around immigration and afraid to report because of that. So we're able to access the Family Justice Center and GBLA and get them advice about their immigration and actually that they can report and they actually get a special kind of visa, a U visa. We're learning a lot about this that protects them against their perpetrators. We get those phone calls, and then we also get, just like Lewis mentioned, culturally competent. Like when somebody calls, it's anonymous, and we call back and we communicate with them. They don't need to explain to me the situation and why it's different. I understand. I grew up in this culture. I get it. And the most amazing part is we've actually been able to help a few gentlemen who call the line, who are dealing with their wives wanting to leave them, and just being an ear for them so they can vent and let it out. Because in our culture, it's hard to go to another man to be like, this happened to me. There's so much pride and shame and ego involved. But yet on our line, you can open up and say what occurred, and we can say it's okay. And we can tell them, like, it's better to let her go and let her leave. And so, I mean, it's been eye-opening to see the type of folks that are calling and the situations that are occurring. And it almost seems like they just needed someone to talk to.
That's extraordinary. It speaks to the power of connection and connectivity.
Yeah. Yeah, that you're not alone and there's nothing to be ashamed of. And some of us are able to share our journeys. You know, I'm from a divorced family. My parents got a divorce when I was 11, and it was like the biggest story to hit our community. I mean, nobody got a divorce in those days. And it's amazing to be able to, he was worried about his children. And that's what he's like, what's going to happen to my kids? And I don't want my kids to grow up with a stepfather, and my kids are going to be destroyed. And sometimes we're able to say, we grew up like that, we're fine. And just to hear that, to know that it's okay. And it's funny, he would call back, this one gentleman called back and said, well, she left today, but you know what? I feel better. He said, I feel more comfortable in my own home now. So, I mean, when you hear that, you realize he just needed someone to talk to who understood and was from the community to be like, oh, this is fine. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's okay. It's your life. So I think that's what the neat part about this resource line is. Obviously, we aren't a crisis center. Like, we would tell them, call 911 if it was an extreme emergency of that nature, to call the police. But what we're seeing more is family issues. It's adjusting to life in America versus culturally how it was back in India. And for us to say, it's okay, you can call the GBLA. And if you want a divorce, you don't have to wait till you're a citizen to get a divorce or, you know, continue to get beat. And sometimes it's just the fact of letting our community members know, the men and the women, because we put our information up at all the temples, that this does exist, because it's almost a deterrent to bullies to realize, oh, wow, my wife can call this number now that's in bilingual, and she can reach out, because it's been quite the buzz in the community. So sometimes that's a deterrent to folks. They realize they no longer have absolute control, that their spouse or their loved one has resources. And that's what we're trying to do, is just make them understand, like, that Andrea and the Family Justice Center is there to serve them. And then there's services there, and Lewis and them are there to serve them, and there's places to go. And just because you might not speak the language doesn't mean that you don't have the right to access.
That's fascinating.
And, yeah.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today we're discussing a new hotline, resource hotline, for the Sikh and Punjabi-speaking communities in Kern County. Deputy DA Kohler, I would love for you to talk about this initiative. It seems to me that it's a real model for partnership in a way that's taking a proactive approach to addressing issues of violence and substance abuse, as opposed to waiting until after a crime has already occurred. Can you speak to how innovative this approach is for your agency?
Yes, and we're so fortunate to have Raji. I mean, she, in this community, she really took the ball and ran with it. And we are actually seeing that it's being utilized. Like she said, it is being utilized. People are calling. And I think that oftentimes, if someone can talk it through with someone who understands what they're going through, then it can serve as very much a deterrent to people who are perpetrating the crimes. But it also, with that sense of community, with that sense of knowing that you're being supported, gives women and men the strength to go forward and that's good for the whole community. You know, we don't want to just focus on prosecution, although as a prosecutor, obviously, we want to hold perpetrators responsible. But this whole approach is hopefully making a difference in the community so that it's proactive instead of reactive. And we're just very fortunate that we have this resource available to us.
We just have a couple minutes left before we need to wrap up. Lewis, I'd love to give you the last word. Can you speak to the power of connection in regards to the work that you do? How big of an impact do you see a hotline like this having?
Violence can be very isolating. And when you're in a relationship where you're being harmed, the individual has typically done a really good job of isolating you from your support network, your family, your friends. And so having somewhere where you can call, talk to someone that understands the life that you've been through, can speak to you in your language, and understand when you talk about the cultural nuances that you're experiencing and those challenges, it can actually feel like there's someone out there for you and you're not alone. And there's a little bit of hope in that. And then we can get people to come in and access additional services so that they do not have to stay afraid, alone, and being harmed. Because everybody deserves to feel safe in their own home.
Well, I thank you all for being with us today and for this resource that you're providing to the community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now for The Weeknd, you're hearing ukulele master Jake Shimabukuro. His latest album, The Greatest Day, was released in late 2018 to critical acclaim. But he's been stretching the boundaries of the instrument's capabilities for a couple of decades now. Currently, he's winding up a U.S. tour, working his way down the West Coast before heading to Japan for a month of tour dates. His trio performs Sunday, October 20th at the Tower Theater in Fresno. FM89's David Aus recently caught up with him.
Jake, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for your time. Thanks for the support. And yeah, I just really appreciate it. It's awesome.
All right. I'd like to start by talking about your latest album, The Greatest Day. And let's get right to it. I'd like to hear about the title song and the title of the album and what they both mean to you.
The title track is... it's an original piece about just staying positive and trying to live each day to the fullest. And every night when I get to get up on stage and play and just think like, man, to have this opportunity and this experience to do what I love and to share that with people, and seems to, you know, bring a positive energy and joy to people. You know, I just think that this new record was just kind of a reflection of that, you know, and the opportunities to keep making music, you know, which is what I love doing.
So the album, The Greatest Day, that came out in 2018, you did in Nashville. That was your second time doing a record in Nashville recently. You'd been there in 2016 for your critically acclaimed Nashville Sessions record that really featured your trio. You have some more players and different things going on in the second album, though.
That first record was very experimental, that Nashville Sessions one. In fact, it wasn't even supposed to be a record. We just rented the studio, and we thought we'd go in there and just jam and try to write, you know, one or two songs. And we ended up writing a whole record and recording a whole record. So that's what that album was. And then the Greatest Day one, the follow-up to that, was we're like, well, let's do the same thing. And we went in there and, you know, just played as a trio. We recorded and wrote things in the studio, kind of approached it like the first record. But instead of just releasing it there, we thought, well, after we record our parts, let's really listen and see, like, what other instruments we can bring in. And that's why this new record, I mean, you hear horns and piano and strings and all kinds of stuff, marimba, a lot of different instrumentation, you know, that I never heard with ukulele before. So it's fun. I mean, it was just kind of not being confined to just the trio sound, but opening it up, you know, to other instruments. So we just called in a lot of studio musicians in Nashville. You know, we thought we're in Nashville, you know, and home of some of the greatest studio musicians in the world. So we just kind of cut loose and just, you know, brought in some of the top session guys.
And that album, The Greatest Day, it's a mix of original materials and like your live set, a mix of original materials and then covers of tunes. How did you go about choosing the songs you were going to cover for the album?
But one of the things I was very excited about was bringing Jerry Douglas, you know, into the studio. I've been a huge fan of his, and we did a Hendrix cover. We did If Six Was Nine, and we also did Eleanor Rigby.
Right.
Just kind of sitting down with him and talking tunes and settling on those songs, you know, was like, man, this is so great. You know, just hearing Jerry Douglas do his thing. And I've been a longtime fan, never got to play with him. You know, I just listened to a lot of his recordings growing up. So being able to sit with him in the studio and just hash out those tunes was just like incredible. And we did everything live, you know, it was just like the two tracks on there. I mean, from beginning to end, you know, those are all right. Live takes. You
just
know?
The real deal. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Now, had you even met Jerry Douglas, of course, one of the great dobro players of all time. Had you even met him before?
I did. I met him once before. He came, we did a show in Nashville, and he actually came, you know, to our performance. So I got to meet him backstage. And I think that's when the seed was planted, you know, because I'd mentioned, hey, you know, we're going to be heading back into the studio, you know, at some point. And he kind of jokingly said, like, well, if you ever need a, you know, dobro player, you know, let me know.
Just give me a call. That's great. We're talking to Jake Shimabukuro, who's going to be in concert in Fresno on Sunday, October 20th at 8 p.m. at the Tower Theater with his trio. For folks who've never seen you in live and performance before, what can an audience expect?
The most important thing is I just want people to walk away from the concert smiling and just feeling good. You know, I like the concert to kind of feel like a movie, you know, where it'll go through a lot of different emotions. You know, like we'll do fun, you know, joyful up-tempo tunes, but then, you know, throughout the set, you know, I may do a song about losing a loved one, you know, or a song about, you know, that or a patriotic number that kind of honors our veterans, you know, and people walk away just feeling good. One of the things we have been doing recently is I have an arrangement of Bohemian Rhapsody that I've been playing, and the audience has been singing along.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
been pretty epic. So.
Epic indeed. So, well, good timing too. Well, that sure sounds like a lot of fun, and I always have a good vibe when I'm listening to your music. So wish you continued success on your tour, success on your new album, Trio, that's coming out in February of next year, and continued success in everything you're doing. Jake, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your time, and thanks for helping to spread the word. We appreciate it.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team. Laura Sitsui, Carrie Klein, Alice Daniel, and Monica Velez. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.